Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, just one last time, let me just tell you, if you live in the Las Vegas area or in driving distance to it, make sure that next weekend, you're hanging out with me and Eric and a whole bunch of other people at the Here We Still Stand regional event in Las Vegas. You can still get tickets, $65 for a two-day event. It is October 15th and 16th. Includes your lunch on Saturday. Come hang out if you're a local especially. Make sure you sign up. The link is in the show notes and it's over there on the site. So you just click on the event and you can register up. We would love to see you. Eric, we left off last week with Jesus being anointed by a woman with perfume. And yes. Jesus says that this is for his burial beforehand, but it won't be long beforehand because the sort of fulfillment of everything that Jesus has come to do is right around the corner.
Yeah, everything is rapidly picking up. We've been in what is historically called Passion Week for a long time. We've been, you know, it's been a few chapters, as is the case with all the Gospels. You get a huge chunk of the narrative focused on this last week of Jesus's life, and we arrive now on Thursday evening, in which they are getting prepared to celebrate the Passover. So we pick it up at Mark 14, verse 12. It says, "And on the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, 'Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?' And he sent two of his disciples and said to them, 'Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, "The teacher says, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. There, prepare for us.' And the disciples set out and went to the city and found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover." So one thing that becomes just very clear, again, a good reminder for us, is that the events that are happening are not accidental. They are being orchestrated. Jesus is in control of his own narrative here. There are going to be events coming up that make the disciples think that he might not be, but he knows exactly what's going to happen. He's already arranged beforehand where he's going to hold the Passover with his disciples, because he knows this is going to be a very significant Passover for his disciples.
Yeah, you got to put yourself in the place of the disciples, where, you know, they said, "Hey, where are we going to do the Passover?" And this is a legitimate question, because you got to do the Passover. I mean, this is not something that the disciples thought they were just going to skip. So they're like, "Hey, it's kind of getting late in the planning time, and like, where are we doing this thing? Are we doing, you know, we obviously they kind of assumed that they were going to all do it together." Jesus said, "Oh, I've got it taken care of. You're going to go out, and when you see this guy, you're going to say this thing." This is very reminiscent of the, you're going to go and see a colt tied to a post and just tell them the master has need of it. Jesus does this sort of thing every once in a while, where he tells the disciples to just trust me, go do this, and it'll work out all right. And sure enough, it does.
Yeah, yeah. It isn't, you got to believe that, you know, by this time they've got to, you know, they sort of go, "Okay, I don't know how he's arranged this, but okay, fine. We'll go and find a guy carrying some water and we'll see what he has to say." And so it says, verse 17, "And when it was evening, he came with the 12, and as they were reclining at table and eating, Jesus said, 'Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me.' They began to be sorrowful and to say to him one after another, 'Is it I?'" Now, what's striking about this to me, Dan, is that each of the disciples knew somewhere down in the recesses of their hearts that they were capable of it. Mm-hmm. Because each of them asks, "Oh no, is it me?" I mean, they know enough now to know that he knows the future. They know he knows who it is, and they're afraid.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know, you got to be honest. I mean, if Jesus, you know, sat down in a room and I was there with, you know, 11 of my buddies, and he said, "One of you is going to betray me," I got to be honest. I would. I don't plan on betraying Christ. I don't plan on leaving the faith or anything like that. But if he said those words, my initial thought would be, "Oh no."
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, so there is a humility here, and there is a recognition, and I think it's a good place for anybody to be, to recognize that indeed we are capable of doing things that we might not even imagine we could do today. It is possible. This is what we call a low anthropology. And I will say the gift of having a low anthropology, which is just to say, we don't ever take for granted that we're capable of greater things than we actually are. We recognize that we are flawed human beings. Put us in the wrong circumstances, or in some cases, what would seem like the right circumstances, and we're capable of doing things that we may never have expected. This keeps us on guard. It keeps us humble. And so he said to them, "It is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." And of course, he's talking about Judas here. He does not reveal that it's Judas, because even to the answer to the question, it's funny, Dan, he doesn't, he's like, "What? Just know it's somebody dipping bread into the dish with me." Like, that doesn't clear up any of the things.
Yeah.
It's like he didn't answer their question.
Oh, yeah. All he affirms is that it is one of them.
That's right.
And, you know, and this sort of statement, you know, that it'd be better for him to have never been born, that seems like, whoa, that's rough. Mm-hmm. But you have to realize that this is a very unique sin, mm-hmm. That is being committed. And,
yes.
And if you know how things go for Judas, then you can understand why Jesus would say that. This is not so much, I don't think, a statement of, "I'm going to ensure that it's better if, like, you know, if somebody did something to you and you said, well, I'm going to go find that person, and when I do, it would have been better if they were never born." It's not that kind of statement. It's
yes.
It's not a threatening statement. It's a statement of fact, mm-hmm. that knowing what we know about how Judas handles his sin, it would have been better.
Yes.
Because it's not the sin that makes it to where, like, it'd been better if Judas had never been born. This is not something that Judas couldn't have been forgiven of or restored from, but because he has no one to absolve him of this sin, he goes and deals with this sin himself,
yes.
And takes his own life. But it's going on here as Jesus is saying, like, this is going to result and play out in such a way that it had been better had he never been.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so verse 22, as they were eating, he took bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to them and said, "Take, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." Well, of course, this is the institution of what we call communion, or the Lord's Supper, or the Eucharist, depending on whatever tradition you happen to be coming from. You know what this meal is. What is significant about this is Jesus. Well, there's a number of things, of course, significant about this, but one of the things is Jesus, by doing this, is reframing the Passover meal. In other words, it is part of this new covenant that he is establishing, where he's taking things that were a shadow or a picture of what will one day be fulfilled and fulfilling them in a new way. And so this Passover meal that pointed to him and the sacrifice that he would make now becomes something that actually is efficacious. It becomes something in which real gifts are given, because the real giver of the gifts has said those gifts are there. In this case, it's the gift of his body and his blood. We don't have to go too much into the weeds in here, but being from the tradition that you and I come from, Dan, when we hear him say, "This is my body, this is my blood," we say, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what Jesus does here during the Passover is he reveals to them what the Passover has always been about. So what's going on in the Passover? We can explain this a little bit. The Passover is a celebration of when God was delivering his people from Egypt on the last and final plague that God sent to convince Pharaoh that he indeed needed to let the people of Israel go. He sent the angel of the Lord out to kill the firstborn of all the land. And what he did was, he had people take a lamb and slaughter it and put the blood on the doorpost, and the angel of the Lord would pass over those houses, and no one in those houses would be harmed. And this is why it's called the Passover. They would take that meal, And they would celebrate it every year as the day that the Lord passed, the wrath of God passed over. Well, what Jesus is saying is, this has always been about what I was going to do, because I am not God, the wrath of God is not going to pass over me. In fact, I am the Lamb. I'm the thing that's going to be slain so that the wrath of God may pass over you. This is what this was always pointing to. So when he then takes this bread and this wine and says, this is my body and this is my blood, he's saying that this is my body, which is going to be broken for you. And this is my blood is going to be shed for you. And I'm going to give you those things. Now, when you had the Passover, they didn't just slaughter a lamb, therefore breaking its body and spilling its blood. And you just, that's all there was to it. They ate it.
Yes.
And this is what Jesus is saying is going to happen with the institution of the Lord's Supper, where he says, I am your Passover lamb, and what I am going to give you in these forms of bread and wine, what it is that you are actually receiving is not just bread and wine, but my very body and blood.
Yes. And as Matthew makes clear in his account of this, the purpose of having this body and blood is for the forgiveness of sins. It delivers something to us. So there's deep significance in what's going on here, and it's why the church has participated in this meal since the very beginning. We can go right away to the book of Acts. As soon as the church is getting established, they are doing this. They are gathering around the supper, and they see it as God's gift to them, as a means by which God delivers grace to them. We call it a means of grace.
Yeah, and if you're sort of struggling with this, maybe think about it this way. What you are receiving when you go and partake of the Lord's Supper is not merely a symbolic thing. Like, I understand the symbolism, but that you're not receiving a mere symbol. You're not receiving a mere sign of something. But what God, the creator of heaven and earth, the one who spoke all things into existence from nothing, the one who can do whatever he wants with whatever he wants, that God is giving you Christ. What you receive in the Lord's Supper is Christ himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I got to tell you, Dan, I mean, there is few things I look forward to partaking in more in my life than communion.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great means of assurance that you can know that when you go to the Lord's table, that what you will receive there is forgiveness of your sins, and what you're receiving is Christ himself. And so how do I know that I'm right with God? How do I know that I'm forgiven by God? Well, one of the ways that I know that is that I heard it again, and then I received that gift from him. And it wasn't just like, you know, somebody told me about it. I actually had these physical things that I put into my mouth. I actually get to eat the promise.
Yeah. And dude, that's such a great thing, because our temptation, our natural inclination is to look within for our sense of assurance. And the problem, of course, with looking within is no matter what you try and do, it's always subjective, and you're never going to be able to judge accurately. Either you're going to overestimate how good you are in order to get your assurance, or you're going to overestimate how bad you are and feel never assured. What the Lord's Supper does, in as well as other means that God has given us, is point us outside of ourselves. I might not be feeling very good. I might be struggling with sins. I might be wondering if I really am a Christian. That voice, you know, harasses us throughout all our days on this earth. But I know I'm a Christian because I had the body and blood of Christ taken. I took in the body and blood of Christ, and where the body and blood of Christ are is the forgiveness of sins, salvation, life everlasting. That's true. It happened to me. It's objective. So there's great comfort there. Great, great comfort.
Yeah, and then you have this other promise that sometimes gets lost in this wonderful promise that he's giving you in his body and blood, which says, I say that I will not drink again the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in the kingdom of God. So Jesus is on a wine fast, as it were, until the second coming, until the new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah.
And so what he's doing is he's saying that I'm going to give you my body and blood. I'm going to give you my blood in and with this wine.
Yes.
And I'm not going to drink Mir wine again until this no longer is necessary.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So in the new heavens and the new earth, we won't be receiving necessarily the body and blood of Christ. We will have Christ in the flesh there with us. Then he will break open the wine casks and we'll have us a big old party.
Yes, that's exactly right. We'll have the marriage feast of the Lamb. And so we move on to verse 26. After Jesus gives his disciples this great, great bit of comfort, it says, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, 'You will all fall away, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.'" Now, remember, Dan, let's connect this with what's just happened. Remember, he says to them, "One of you will betray me." And they say, "Is it me? Is it I? I don't know. Well, now he's saying, "Well, maybe not all of you will betray me, but you're all going to fall away."
Yeah.
So they've got to be really afraid right now. I mean, they've got to be really afraid of, like, what is going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, well, he's saying one of you is going to betray me, and what that's going to result in is the rest of you running.
Yeah. And so sure enough, you know, "For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." They are going to scatter. "But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." And Peter, blessed Peter, Peter said to him, "Even though they all fall away, I will not." Now, you got to just picture, Dan, him like looking at his fellow brethren disciples and pointing at them as he says, like, "Hey, Matthew, I know, you know, maybe, I mean, hey, man, I get it. He's fallen away. Sure. Simon the Zealot, yeah, he'll probably go back to his zealotry. Thomas, yeah, well, you know, we already know about Thomas. But you know me. You know me, Jesus. I'm reliable. I'm going to stand with you to the very end.
Yeah.
Don't worry."
Yeah, and it's funny that because Jesus says to them, you know, "For it is written." So Jesus is like, "Hey, you're all going to fall away because the prophets had said so." And Peter's like, "Yeah, the prophets hadn't met me, though. Here's the thing. I don't know if we're like got the translation right. Like by scatter, I think it's talking about these other guys.
Yeah.
But not me."
Yeah, it's a pretty bold statement. I think Peter is 100% sincere in this moment. I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's, you know, blowing smoke. I think he really means it. Like, no. I am true to the end. I'm a loyal guy. And he is. He's been a loyal guy. "And Jesus said to him, 'Truly, I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.' But he said emphatically, 'If I must die with you, I will not deny you.' And they all said the same."
So here's what you have happen here is Jesus says they're all going to scatter. Peter says, "All these other chumps might scatter. There's no chance I scatter." And Jesus says, "Oh, you're going to do more than scatter. You're going to run, and then you're going to deny that you even know me." And so he's telling Peter, like, it's not just what I said. It's way what you're going to do is it goes beyond that.
Yep.
And then he says, "Look, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And then you have this thing where they all said the same. So at this point,
what else are they going to do? You know, like they got it, right?
Yeah. At this point, they're like, nobody's running. No one's denying. None of that's going to happen. Of course, all of that is going to happen.
Yes, indeed. And Jesus knows this. And yet, you know, they won't listen. They have to experience it before they can acknowledge the truth of this.
Can you imagine, though, like how rough this is? I mean, imagine that God is standing there before you and he says, "Listen, something bad's going to happen and you're all going to leave me." And you think, "Well, I'm not going to do that." And you're like, no, I won't do that. And then he tells you, "Well, not only are you going to leave me, you're going to deny that you even know me." Mm-hmm. This has got to be, this is a tough word to hear.
No, it's, and yet, even in the midst of delivering this very hard thing to hear, what does he say right afterwards? "But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee."
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm not abandoning you. Like, you're going to fall away from me, and I know this, but I'll come and get you.
Yep.
I'm going to come after you because that's who I am. That's still who he is today.
Yep.
Every day. He is the shepherd that runs after the lost sheep, that leaves the 99. That's who he is. And so even as he delivers this harsh truth to them, he also delivers them a promise that he is going to be the one that chases them. So we pick it up at verse 32, and they went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And when he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it was possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Well, this is obviously, Dan, a remarkable, remarkable statement, and really gives us an insight into the anguish that Jesus is feeling as he approaches the cross. So even as we acknowledge all throughout the narrative that he is here to do this very thing, that he knows what he's come here to do, he also knows the brutal, brutal pain, not just physically, but spiritually, that he's going to have to endure, something he's never had to endure in all of eternity past. And yeah, it's natural. He doesn't want to face it.
As the cross is coming closer, I mean, think about the things that he just said. He's spent 3 years traveling around with this group of guys and teaching them. And he's just told them that in my greatest hour of need, you're all going to run. You're all going to scatter. One's going to betray me. Another's going to deny me. I'm going to go through this alone. This is obviously what Jesus has to go through. It's difficult to go through if you had all the support in the world. But Jesus knows that he has to be abandoned by those close to him, by his friends. And this, it sounds weird about God having friends and stuff, but these are Jesus' friends.
Yes.
And he will call Judas his friend when he betrays him. And so he's going to be betrayed by his friends, denied by his friends, left alone by his friends, and left by his father. Mm-hmm. He is going to be forsaken, as he says. And so Jesus is about to experience a degree of aloneness that nobody has ever experienced.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever been abandoned or forsaken the way that Jesus knows he is about to be. So, of course, the torture and then the final death on the cross, of course, this is all excruciating and something that no one wants to face down. It's not just that. It's that he has to go do that, and he has to do that all alone, and then to be forsaken by God himself.
Yeah. Yes, and it is fitting, of course, that this is all taking place in a place called Gethsemane, which is literally the place, the olive press. And you just get the picture of what happens in an olive press, you know, where it's literally like a gigantic stone is rolled on top of olives so that all of the oil from the olives is squeezed out. That's what Jesus is facing spiritually and mentally right now. He feels like he is being just absolutely crushed. I mean, we know from Luke's account of this moment that Jesus has so much stress as he's praying that he actually has drops of blood from the stress he's feeling. So this is the crucible, so to speak. And yet it says he came and found his disciples sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Now, Dan, this is a crew that like 5 verses ago just, just said, "We got your back." And now they're sleeping.
Yeah, I'm a little bit sympathetic to disciples here. I mean, I know if Jesus said to me, "Could you not pray for 1 hour?" My answer is like, no, I could not. I remember Bible study. We had prayer meetings as a kid, and they would have these things on like Wednesday nights or something, and you'd go in there, and they'd have the sanctuary all dark, and then they'd have like worship music on, and people just gonna pray for hours. Well. I always fell asleep. I would try very difficult, and I'd be, you'd get down.
Fell asleep in the Lord.
Yeah, you get on your hands and knees, and the next thing you know, your face is buried in the cushion of the chair that you're in, and you, you know, someone says amen really loud, and you, you just startle up, and you got drool running down your face, and tweed print in your on the side of your cheek, and so I get it. Like I probably am about as good a prayer as old Simon Peter here. But, you know, here Jesus is saying that, like, I mean, is there a statement that has ever rang more true than the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak? I mean, this is like the theme of my life.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'd like to pray for that long.
Yeah.
But man, my flesh is weak. Now, I will say the only thing, because your defense of the disciples here is, of course, I can relate to it so much. I really can. But. You would think if there was a time that they might be able to stay awake in the midst of all this discussion of arrest and betrayal and death, that this might be the moment. But no, and it just goes to show, I mean, it's comforting to me because these guys who Jesus chose to make his crew are just like you and I.
Yep.
They're just like us. I mean, they're not superstars. They're not, you know, saint rock stars. They're just like you and I. They're prone to the same weaknesses and struggles that all of us are. And so it says, again, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. So the hour has come. This is the moment where it's all coming to a head. And now they're definitely not sleeping down. This has had to jar them awake. What do you mean, right now?
Yeah. Well, I think an interesting question is that what is it that Jesus is asking them to pray for? You know, you have this pray that you may not, you know, fall into temptation. In this moment, Jesus is not asking them to pray for him.
That's right.
He is simply asking them to pray.
Yes.
Because what Jesus also knows, as horrific as this is going to be for him, and he obviously is in deep anguish over this, that the disciples are about to be in a very difficult situation. They're about to see everything, the man that they have placed all their hopes in, and they have believed in this person, and they're going to see him humiliated and mocked and tortured and killed. And he is telling them now would be a great time for you to pray for strength. Because I know, like, the spirit is willing with all this. I will never leave you or forsake you talk. But what you're about to enter into is going to be difficult. And man, it tells you something about the heart of Jesus that what he would desire, that this would even be on his mind at this time, that I'm going to go to my Father and pray. You should too, because this is going to be difficult for you.
Yeah. You can just see that Jesus has his disciples in the forefront of his mind, even as he's going through his own personal anguish here. And as he prepares to meet his betrayer, as he prepares to be falsely accused and go through all sorts of mockery and humiliation, he always does so with his disciples, with the world on the forefront of his mind, because that is who he has come to save.
That's right. And that's exactly where we'll leave it. Next week, we will get into the actual betrayal and arrest of Jesus and the rest of Passion Week. But we'll have to do that next time. Eric, I'll see you then.
All right. Sounds good.